Winter Maiden goes out, then the seven goats and the pitcher. The eye, which shines brightest and longest, goes out. The line of the horizon is lit up by the short-lived brightness of lightning. Thunder rolls with a dull rumble. The wind abruptly intensifies, blowing dust and dry leaves into their eyes. The unicorn neighs and sends a mental signal. There's no time to lose. Our only hope is in a quick escape, to the right place and the right time. We must hurry, Star Eye. I'm the master of worlds. I am the Elder Blood. I am of the blood of Lara Doran, the daughter of Shyadal. Ihwarahwak's neighs urges them on. Kelpie echoes it with a long drawn-out snort. Ciri puts on her gloves. I'm ready, she says. A buzzing in her ears. A flash and brightness. And then darkness. The trial, sentence and execution of Joachim de Wet is usually ascribed by most historians to the violent, cruel and tyrannical nature of Emperor Emir, and neither is there any shortage either, particularly amongst authors of a literary bent, of elusive hypotheses about revenge and the settling of wholly private scores. It is high time the truth were told. The truth, which for every attentive scholar is more than obvious. Duke de Wet commanded the Verden group in such a way that the term inept is much too mild. Having against him forces twice as weak as his own, he delayed the offensive to the north and directed all his efforts towards a fight against the Verdanian guerrillas. The Verden group committed unspeakable atrocities against the civilian population. The result was easy to predict and was inevitable. If, in the winter, the forces of the insurgents had numbered less than 500,000, by spring almost the entire country had risen up. King Ervil, who had been devoted to the empire, was eliminated, and the insurrection was led by his son, Prince Kistrin, who sympathized with the Nordlings. Having on his flank a landing force of pirates from Skellige, to the fore, an offensive of Nordlings from Sidaris, and at the rear, a rebellion, de Wet became entangled in piecemeal engagements, suffering defeat after defeat. In the process, he delayed the offensive of the centre army group. Instead of, as had been planned, engaging the Nordlings' wing, the Verden group tied down Menokuhorn. The Nordlings immediately exploited the situation and went on the counterattack, breaking through the encirclement near Maena and Maribor, and thwarting the chances of those vital forts being swiftly captured a second time. The ineptitude and stupidity of de Wet also had a psychological significance. The myth of Nilfgaard's invincibility was broken. Scores of volunteers began to flock to the army of the Nordlings. Restif de Montholon, The Northern Wars, Myths, Lies and Half-Truths. Chapter 6. Yara, what else can be said, was very disappointed. An upbringing in a temple and his own open nature made him believe in people, in their goodness, kindness, and selflessness. Not much remained of that faith. He had already slept two nights in the open among the remains of hayricks, and now it looked like he would be spending a third night in a similar fashion. In every village where he asked for a bed or a piece of bread, he was answered with either a weighty silence or insults and threats from behind securely locked gates. It didn't help when he said who he was and why he was travelling. He was very, very disappointed in people. It was quickly growing dark. The boy marched jauntily and briskly along a path between some fields. He spotted a hayrick, resigned and downcast at the prospect of another night under the open sky. March was admittedly extremely warm, but it got cold at night, and very frightening. Yara looked up at the sky, where, as it had been every night for almost a week, the gold and red bee of a comet was visible, crossing the sky from the west to the east, dragging in its wake a flickering plait of fire. He wondered what this strange phenomenon, mentioned in many prophecies, might actually augur. he started walking again. It was growing darker and darker. The track led downwards into an avenue of dense undergrowth that assumed terrifying shapes in the semi-darkness. From below, where it was even darker, drifted the cold, foul smell of rotting weed and something else. Something very unpleasant. Yara stopped. He tried to persuade himself that what was crawling over his back and shoulders was not fear, but cold. Unsuccessfully. A low footbridge connected the banks of a canal, overgrown with osiers and misshapen willows, black and shining like freshly pared pitch. Long holes gaped in the footbridge, in places where the timbers had rotted and caved in, and the handrail was broken, its spindles submerged in the water. The willows grew more thickly beyond the bridge. Although it was still a long way to the actual night, although the distant meadows beyond the canal were still glowing with a yarn of mist hanging on the top of the grass, darkness reigned among the willows. Yara saw the vague ruins of a building in the gloom, probably a mill, sluice, or eel smokery. "I must cross that footbridge," thought the lad. "There's nothing to be done. Although I feel in my bones that something evil is lurking in the darkness, I must get to the other side of this canal. I must cross this canal, like that mythical leader or hero I read about in yellowed manuscripts in the Temple of Melitela. I'll traverse this canal, and then, what was it? The cards will have been dealt. No, the dice will have been cast. Behind me lies my past, before me stretches my future." He stepped onto the bridge, and at once knew that his sense of foreboding hadn't been mistaken, before he even saw them or heard them.
"Well," rasped one of the men who now blocked his way, "didn't I say? I said, just wait a tick and someone will appear."
"Exactly, Okoltich,"
another of the characters, armed with clubs, lisped slightly.
"Verily, we'll have to make you a fortune-teller or a wise man. Well, gentle passer-by, walking all alone, will you give us what you have of your own free will, or will it have to come to a struggle?"
"I don't have anything,"
yelled Yara at the top of his voice, although he didn't have much hope that anybody would hear and rush to help.
"I'm a poor wanderer. I don't have a groat to my name. What can I give you? This cane? These garments?"
"Not only that," said the lisping one,
and something in his voice made Yara tremble.
"For you ought to know, poor wanderer, that in truth, being in urgent need, we're looking out for a wench. Well, night's just around the corner. No one else is coming now, so beggars can't be choosers. Grab him, boys."
"I have a knife,"
yelled Yara.
"I'm warning you."
He had a knife, indeed. He'd swiped it from the temple kitchen the day before his flight and hidden it in his bundle. But he didn't reach for it. He was paralyzed and terrified by the realization that it was pointless and that nothing would help him.
"I have a knife."
"Well, prithee," sneered the lisping one, approaching. "He has a knife. Who'd have thought it?"
Yara couldn't run away. Terror turned his legs into two posts stuck into the ground. Adrenaline seized him by the throat like a noose.
"Hi there,"
a third character suddenly shouted, in a young and strangely familiar voice.
"I think I know him." "Yes, yes, I know him. Let him be, I say. He's a pal. Yara, do you recognise me? I'm Milfy. Hey, Yara, do you recognise me?"
Yes, I do.
Yara fought against the hideous, overwhelming, previously unfamiliar sensation with all his strength. Only when he felt a pain in his hip, which had smashed against a timber of the bridge, did he understand what the sensation was. The sensation of losing consciousness.
"Oh, this is a surprise," said Melfi. "Why, a fluke among flukes. Why, coming across a fellow countryman, a pal from Ellender, a mate, eh, Yara?"
Yara swallowed a bite of the hard, rubbery piece of fatback that his strange company had given him, and ate a bit of roasted turnip. He didn't reply, but only nodded towards the whole group of six surrounding the campfire.
"And which way are you going, Yara?"
"To Vichima."
"Ha! We're heading to Vichima too. Why, a fluke among flukes. What, Milton? Remember Milton, Yara?"
Yara didn't. He wasn't certain if he had ever seen him. As a matter of fact, Melfi was exaggerating a little in calling him a pal. He was the cooper's son from Elender. When the two of them used to attend the temple school, Melfi would regularly and severely beat Yara and call him a bastard without a mother or father begotten in the nettles. This went on for about a year, after which the cooper took his son out of school, since it had been proved that his offspring was only fit for barrels. Thus Melfi, rather than toiling to learn the arcana of reading and writing, toiled to whittle staves in his father's workshop. And after Yara had completed his studies, and on the strength of a recommendation from the temple became an assistant scribe in the magistrate's court, the cooper's son, following the example of his father, bowed to him, gave him presents, and declared his friendship.
"We're going to Vichemer," Melfi continued his tale, "to join up. All of us here to a man are going to join the army. These here, look, Milton and Ogrebeck, peasant boys, have been selected for the acreage duty. Why, you know, I do."
Yara cast his eyes over the peasant sons, fair-haired and as alike as brothers, chewing some unrecognisable food roasted in the cinders. "One for each 20 and 10 acres, the acreage levy. And you, Melfi?"
"With me," sighed the cooper's son, "it's like this, see? The first time the guilds had to supply a recruit, my father got me out of trouble. But when the poverty came, we had to draw lots a second time, because the town so decided. Well, you know."
"I do," nodded Yara again. "An additional lottery for the levy was decreed by a resolution of Elender Town Council on the day of the 16th of January. It was necessary, owing to the Nilfgaardian threat."
"Just listen to him talk, Pike,"
raspingly interjected the thick-set and shaven-headed fellow, the one called Okultich, who had hailed him on the bridge not long before.
"Thop, know it all."
"Smart, Alec,"
drawled another huge farmhand with a dopey smile permanently plastered onto his round face.
"Know all."
"Shut it, Clapperoth,"
slowly lisped the one called Pike, the oldest of the company, sturdy with a drooping moustache and a shaved nape.
"Since he's a know-it-all, it's worth listening when he talks. There may be a benefit from it. Facts. And facts never harmed anyone. Well, almost never. And almost no one."
"I'll second that," announced Melfi. Yara, is indeed clever. Knows his letters. A scholar. I mean, he works as a court scribe in Elender, and at the Temple of Melitila, the whole book collection is under his care."
"What then, I wonder,"
interrupted Pike, staring at Yara through the smoke and sparks,
"is a sodding court temple librarian doing on the highway to Vichemer?"
"Just like you," said the boy. "I'm going to join the army."
"And what?"
Pike's eyes shone, reflecting the glow like the eyes of a real fish in the light of a torch on the bow of a boat.
"What is a court temple scholar hoping to find in the army? For he can't be going to join up, eh? Why, any fool knows that temples are exempt from the levy. They don't have to supply recruits. And any fool knows that every single court is capable of defending its scribe and wrangling him out of joining the army. So what's it all about, Master Clark?"
"I'm joining the army as a volunteer," declared Yara. "I'm signing up myself, of my own free will, not from the levy. Partly for personal reasons, but mainly from patriotic duty."
The company roared with loud, thunderous general laughter.
"Hey, boys," Pike finally said. "What contradictions sometimes lurk in a body. Two natures. Here we have a young shaver, it would seem, educated and worldly and undoubtedly clever by nature on top of all that. He ought to know what's happening in the war, know who's fighting whom and who will soon utterly defeat whom. And he, as you've heard, without being forced, of his own free will, out of patriotic duty, wants to join the losing party."
No one commented, Yara included.
"Such a patriotic duty," Pike finally said, "is usually only the mark of the feeble-minded. Why, perhaps it even befits Temple Court alumni. But there was talk here of some sort of personal reasons. I'm awful curious as to what those personal reasons might be."
"They're so personal," Yara cut him off, "that I'm not going to talk about them. All the more so since you, good sir, are in no hurry to talk about your reasons."
"Now, Heed," said Pike a moment later, Where some boor to talk to me like that, he'd get a punch in the mush right off. Well, if he's a learned scribe, I'll forgive him just this once. And say I'm also going to join up, and also as a volunteer.
In order, like one of the feeble-minded, to join the losers? It surprised Yara himself where so much insolence had suddenly come from. Fleecing travellers on bridges en route.
He, chortled Melfi, anticipating Pike. He's still mad at us for that ambush on the footbridge.
Let it go, Yara. It was only a prank. Just innocent tricks. Right, Pike?
Right.
Pike yawned and snapped his teeth so loud it echoed.
Just innocent tricks. Life is sad and glum. Just like a calf being led to the slaughter. Then only tricks or pranks can cheer it up. Don't you think so, Scribe?
I do, by and large.
That's good.
Pike didn't lower his shining eyes from him.
For otherwise, you'd be a miserable companion for us, and it would be better if you walked to Vichima by yourself. Right away, for instance.
Yara said nothing. Pike stretched.
I said what I meant to say. Well, mates, we fooled round, frolicked, had our fun, and now it's time. If we're to be in Vichima by supper time, we ought to set off with the sun.
The night was very cold, and Yara couldn't sleep despite his tiredness. He was curled up in a ball under his mantle, with his knees almost touching his chin. When he finally fell asleep, he slept badly, his dreams constantly waking him up. He couldn't remember most of them, apart from two. In the first dream, the witcher Geralt of Rivia was sitting beneath long icicles hanging from a rock, motionless, covered in ice and being quickly buried under drifting snow. In the other dream, Ciri was galloping on a black horse, hugging its mane along an avenue of misshapen alders that were trying hard to seize her with their crooked boughs. Oh, and just before dawn, he dreamed of Triss Merigold. After her stay in the temple the year before, the boy had dreamed about the sorceress several times. The dreams had made Yara do things which he was very ashamed of afterwards. This time, naturally, nothing shameful happened. It was too cold. All seven of them set off in the morning, barely after the sun rose. Milton and Ogrebeck, the peasant sons from the acreage duty, fortified themselves by singing a soldier song.
Here rides the warrior, armour glinting bright. Flee, young lass, he'll steal a kiss this night. And wherefore not? Who will stay his hand? For his keen blade defends the motherland.
Pike, Akultich, Klaproth, and Melfi, the cooper's son, who had attached himself to them, were telling each other anecdotes and stories, extremely funny ones, in their opinion.
And the Nilfgaardian asks, what stings around here? And the elf says, shit.
And do you know this one? An Nilfgaardian, an elf and a dwarf were walking along. They look, a mouse is scampering.
The longer the day went on, the more other wanderers, peasants' carts, bailiffs and small squads of marching soldiers they encountered on the highway. Some of the carts were crammed with goods. Pike's gang followed them with their noses almost touching the ground like pointers, gathering whatever fell. Here a carrot, there a potato, a turnip, occasionally even an onion. Some of the loot they cleverly put away for a rainy day, and some they greedily devoured without even interrupting their joke-telling. And the Nilfgaardian goes and shits himself right up to the ears.
Oh, gods, I can't bear it. Shat himself.
Yara was waiting for an opportunity and a pretext to wander off. He wasn't keen on Pike. He wasn't keen on Akultich. He wasn't keen on the glances which Pike and Akultich were casting at the passing merchants' wagons, peasants' carts, and the women and girls sitting on them. He wasn't keen on Pike's sneering tone, since he kept talking about the usefulness of signing up as a volunteer when defeat and extermination were certain and self-evident. There was a smell of ploughed earth and smoke. They saw the roofs of buildings in the valley, among a regular patchwork of fields, groves and fish ponds, gleaming like mirrors. Sometimes the distant barking of a dog, the lowing of an ox, or the crowing of a cock reached their ears.
"You can see these villagers are wealthy," Pike lisped, licking his lips. "Small, but fancy."
"Halflings live and farm here in the valley," Akultich hurried to explain. "Everything about them's fancy and pretty. A thrifty little nation, those midgets."
"Damned inhumans," rasped Klaproth. "Bloody kobolds. They farm here, and poverty and misery befalls real people because of creatures like them. Even war doesn't harm such as them."
"For now."
Pike stretched his mouth in an ugly smile.
"Remember this village, lads. The outermost one, among those birches, right in the forest. Remember it well. If I ever desire to visit here again, I wouldn't want to go astray."
Yara turned his head away. He pretended he couldn't hear, that all he could see was the highway in front of him. They walked on. Milton and Ogrebek, the peasant sons from the acreage duty, sang a new song, less sultry, perhaps a little more pessimistic, which could, particularly after Pike's earlier allusions, be considered a bad omen.
"Hark and think on what I say, I shall speak of death today, for no matter how old you be, you'll not escape its misery. Be ever mindful of your due, for death will surely throttle you."
"Hey," judged Akultich morosely, "must have cash. If he doesn't have cash, may me balls be cut off."
The individual about whom Akultich had made such a ghastly bet was a wandering trader, hurrying beside a donkey-drawn cart.
"Dosh or no dosh," lisped Pike. "The donkey must be worth something. Hasten your steps, boys."
"Melfi," Yara seized the cooper's son by his sleeve. "Open your eyes. Can't you see what's being planned?"
"Oh, they're only jokes, Yara."
Melfi wrenched himself free. "Just jokes." The trader's cart, it was evident from close up, was at the same time a stall and could be set up within a few moments. The whole donkey-drawn construction was covered in garishly and picturesquely sprawling writing, in which the goods on sale included balsams and remedies, protected talismans and amulets, elixirs, magical filters and poultices, cleaning agents and, furthermore, detectors of metals, ores and truffles, and fail-safe baits for fish, ducks and wenches. The trader, a thin old man weighed down by the burden of his years, looked around, saw them, cursed and drove his donkey on. But the donkey, like all donkeys, had no intention of going any faster.
"Fine robes on that one," judged Akultich quietly, "and we'll certainly find the little something on the cart."
"Very well, boys," said Pike. "Chop, chop. We'll deal with this matter while there are few witnesses on the road."
Yara, astonished at his courage, pulled ahead of the company in a few swift paces and turned around, standing between them and the merchant.
"No,"
he said, fighting to get a word out of his tight throat.
"I won't allow it."
Pike slowly opened his coat and displayed a long knife shoved into his belt, clearly as sharp as a razor.
"Out of the road, scribbler," he lisped malevolently, "if you respect your neck. I thought you'd fit into our company, but no. Your temple, I see, has made you overly sanctimonious. You stink overly of pious incense. So out of the way, for otherwise..."
"And what's going on here, eh?"
Two strange shapes emerged from behind the stout and spreading willows which flanked the highway and were the most common feature of the Ismena Valley's scenery. The two men wore waxed and upwardly twisted moustaches, colourful puffed breeches, quilted short jackets decorated with ribbons and huge, soft velvet berets with bunches of feathers. Apart from the sabres and daggers hanging from their broad belts, the two men carried on their backs double-handed swords, probably 2 yards long, with hilts measuring 2 feet and large curved crossguards. These lanzknechts were hopping up and down and fastening their trousers. Neither of them made even a movement toward the hilts of their terrible swords, but in any case, Pike and Akultich immediately became more docile and the huge Klaproth shrank like a deflated goatskin.
"We're doing nothing," lisped Pike. "Nothing we shouldn't.
Just pranks," squealed Melfi. "No one's been harmed,"
unexpectedly piped up the stooping trader.
"No one. We," Yara quickly interjected, "are going to Vachima to join up. Perhaps you're going the same way, noble sirs?"
"Indeed we are," the Landsknecht snorted, realizing at once what this was about. "We head for Vachima. Whoever wishes may go with us. It will be safer."
"Safer, I swear,"
added the other one knowingly, eyeing Pike up and down.
"It behoves me to add, indeed, that not long ago we saw a mounted patrol in the vicinity of the Vachiman bailiwick. They are most inclined to hang, and miserable will be the fate of any marauder whom they catch in the act."
"And it's most good."
Pike had regained his aplomb and grinned a gap-toothed smile.
"My lords, it's good, gentlemen, that there is law and punishment for rogues. That is the correct order of things. Thus let us set off to Vachima, to the army, for our patriotic duty summons us."
The Landsknecht looked at him long and quite contemptuously, then shrugged, straightened his great sword on his back, and set off down the road. His companion, Yara, as well as the merchant with his donkey and cart, set off after him, and at the rear, some distance away, shambled Pike's rabble.
"Thank you, sir knights,"
the merchant said some time later, driving his donkey with a withy.
"And thank you, young master."
"It's nothing."
The Landsknecht waved a hand. "We're accustomed to it."
"Various characters are drawn to the army."
His companion looked back over his shoulder.
"The order comes to a village or small town to supply a recruit for every 500 acres, and sometimes that method is used to rid themselves right away of the worst sort of scoundrel. And then the roads are full of nuisances like that lot there. Well, in the army, the lance corporal's rod will teach them obedience. Those rascals will learn discipline when they've run the gauntlet once or twice, faced the rows of lashes."
Yara hurried with an explanation, "am signing on as a volunteer, not compulsorily."
"Commendable, commendable."
The Landsknecht glanced at him and twisted the waxed ends of his moustaches.
"And I see you are moulded from somewhat different clay than those men. Why are you with them?"
"Fate brought us together."
"I've seen such chance encounters and fraternizing before."
The soldier's voice was grave. It led the fraternizers to the same gibbet.
"Learn a lesson from that, lad."
"I shall."
Before the cloud-darkened sun had stood at the zenith, they reached the main road. Here, a forced break in their journey awaited them, as it did a large group of wanderers who also had to stop, for the main road was packed full of marching soldiers.
"Southwards,"
one of the Landsknechts commented knowingly on the direction of the march.
"To the front, to Maribor and Maena." "Heed their standards,"
the other one indicated with his head.
"Redanians," said Yara. "Silver eagles on crimson."
"You've guessed right."
The Landsknecht slapped him on the back.
"You're a truly smart youngster. That's the Redanian army which Queen Hedwig has sent to aid us. Now we are strong in unity. Temeria, Redania, Adian, and Caedwin. Now we're all allies, supporters of one cause."
"A bit late,"
said Pike, with a pronounced sneer from behind their backs. The Landsknecht looked back, but said nothing.
"So let's sit down," suggested Melfi, "and give our pins a rest. There's no end in sight of that army. It'll be ages before the road frees itself up."
"Let's sit down," said the merchant, "yonder, on that hill. The view will be better from there."
The Redanian cavalry rode by, and after them, raising dust, marched crossbowmen and pavisiers. After them, a column of heavy cavalry trotted past.
"And they," Melfi pointed to the armoured troops, "are marching under different colours. They have black standards flecked with something white."
"Ah, the ignorant provinces."
The Landsknecht glanced at him contemptuously.
"They don't know their own king's arms. They are silver lilies, blockhead."
"Field sable with lilies argent," said Yara,
who all of a sudden felt a desire to prove that of all people he wasn't from the ignorant provinces. "In the kingdom of Temeria's former coat of arms," he began, "there was a lion passant, but the Temerian royal dukes used a different one. To be precise, they added an extra field to the shield, containing three lilies. Since in heraldic symbolism the lily flower is a sign of the successor to the throne, the royal son, the heir to the throne and scepter.
So didn't know it all, barked Klaproth. You can shut your gob, clothhead, said the Landsknecht menacingly. And you, lad, go on. This is interesting.
And when Prince Goidemar, the son of old King Gardik, went to fight against the insurgents of the she-devil Falka, the Temerian army, under his standard, under the emblem of the lily, fought and won decisive victories. And when Goidemar inherited the throne from his father, he established three lilies argent on a field sable as the kingdom's coat of arms, as a memento of those victories, and for the miraculous escape of his wife and children from the hands of the enemy. And later, King Cedric changed the state coat of arms by a special decree so that it's a black shield aspersed with silver lilies. And the Temerian coat of arms has been like that ever since, which you may all easily confirm for yourself, since the Temerian lancers are riding along the main road right now.
You have worked it out very elegantly, young master, said the merchant.
Not I, Yara sighed, but John of Aethra, a heraldic scholar.
And you are no worse schooled, I see. Perfect for a recruit, added Pike under his breath, to be clubbed to death under the standard of those silver lilies for the king and Temeria.
They heard singing, menacing, soldierly, booming like a sea wave, like the growl of an approaching storm. Following the Temerians passed other soldiers in close and even array. Grey, almost colourless cavalrymen, over which neither standards nor pennants fluttered. A pole with a horizontal bar decorated with horses' tails and three human skulls nailed to it was being borne in front of the commanders riding at the head of the column.
The Free Company,
the first Landsknecht subtly indicated the grey riders.
Mercenaries, soldiers of fortune.
They're clearly stout-hearted, gasped Melfi. Every man, and they're marching in step as though on parade.
The Free Company, the Landsknecht repeated. Take a good look, O peasants and striplings, at a genuine soldier. They've been in battle before. It was they, those mercenaries, the companies of Adam Pangrat, Mola, Frontin and Abatamarco, who tipped the scales at Myena. Thanks to them, the Nilfgaardian encirclement was broken. We owe it to them that the fortress was liberated.
Brave and doughty folk indeed, those mercenaries, added the other. As unyielding in battle as a rock. Though the Free Company serves for coin, as you can easily mark from their song.
The troop approached at a walk, their thunderous song sounding a strong and booming, but strangely gloomy, bitter note.
No scepter nor throne will win us over, we shall never be in league with kings. We are in the service of the Duquette that glitters in the sun. Your oaths are nothing to us. We do not kiss your standards or your hands. We swear faith to the Duquette that glitters in the sun.
Hey, to serve with them, sighed Melfi again. To fight together with such as them. A man with no glory and spoils.
Do my eyes fail me or what? Okultich screwed up his face. At the head of the 2nd Regiment. A woman? Do those soldiers of fortune fight under the command of a woman?
She's a woman, confirmed the Landsknecht. But not just any woman. That's Julia Abatamarco, who they call Pretty Kitty. She's some warrior.
Under her command, the mercenaries demolished the Blackcoats and Elven troops at Maena, even though only 2,500 of them assailed 3,000.
I've heard, said Pike,
in a strange, repulsively obsequious, but at the same time malicious tone,
that the victory didn't count for much, that the ducats spent on the mercenaries went down the drain. Nilfgaard regrouped and gave our boys a thrashing and a sound one, and encircled Myena again. And perhaps they've already captured the stronghold. And perhaps they're already heading here. Perhaps they'll be here any day. Perhaps those corrupt mercenaries were bribed with Nilfgaardian gold long ago, and perhaps...
And perhaps, interrupted the Landsknecht, enraged. You want a punch in the face, you churl.
Beware, for running down our army is punished by the nooks, so shut your trap while I'm in a good mood.
Ooh,
The bruiser Klaproth, mouth wide open, diffused the situation.
Oh, look! Look at those funny short horses!
An infantry formation armed with halberds, guisarme, battle axes, flails and morning stars marched along the road to the dull thud of drums, the fierce hooting of bagpipes and the shrill whistling of fifes. Dressed in fur cloaks, mail shirts and pointed pot helmets, the soldiers were indeed extremely short.
"Dwarves from the mountains," exclaimed the first Landsknecht, one of the Mahakam volunteer foot.
"I thought," said Akultich, "that the dwarves weren't with us, but against us. That those foul short horses had betrayed us and were in league with the Blackcloaks.
You thought?"
The Landsknecht glanced at him piteously.
"Using what, I wonder? If you swallowed a cockroach with your soup, dolt, you'd have more intelligence in your guts than in your head.
Those marching there are one of the dwarven foot regiments that Bruvahug, the headman of Mahakam, has sent us as succor. Most of them have also seen action, suffered great losses, so they've been withdrawn to Vichima to regroup."
"The dwarves are valiant folk," confirmed Melfi. "When one of them thumped me in the ear in the tavern in Elendur at Samhain, it rang until Yule."
"The dwarven regiment is the last in the column."
The Landsknecht shaded his eyes with a hand.
"That's the end of the march. The road will soon be empty. Let's prepare to set off, for it's almost noon."
"So many military folk are marching south," said the seller of amulets and remedies, "that there's surely going to be a great war. Great misfortune will fall on the people. Great defeats on the armies. Thousands of folk will die from fire and sword. So, consider, gentlemen, that this comet, which can be seen in the sky every night, trails a fiery red tail behind it. If a comet's tail is blue or pale, it heralds cold ailments, chills, pleurisy, phlegm and catarrh, and such aquatic misfortunes as floods, downpours, or long periods of rainy weather. While a red colour indicates that it's a comet of fevers, blood and fire, and also of the iron which springs from the fire. Dreadful, dreadful defeats will befall the people. Great pogroms and massacres will happen. As it says in the prophecy, corpses will pile up to a height of a dozen ells. Wolves shall howl on the desolate ground, and men will kiss other men's footsteps. Oh, woe to us."
"Why to us?" the Landsknecht interrupted coolly. "The comet is flying high. It can also be seen from Nilfgaard, not to mention the Aina Valley, whence they say Menokuhorn is approaching. The Black Cloaks are also looking at the sky and also see the comet. Why then should we not assume that it foretells their defeat and not ours, that their corpses will be piled up?"
"That's right," snapped the other Landsknecht. "Woe to them, to the Black Cloaks."
"You've worked it out elegantly, gentlemen."
"Certainly."
They passed by the forest surrounding Vichima and entered meadows and pastures. Entire herds of horses were grazing there of various kinds, cavalry, harness and draft horses. There was next to no grass on the meadows, it being March, but there were wagons and barracks full of hay.
"See that?"
Akultich licked his lips.
"Aye, fine little horses. And no one's gold in them. There for the taking."
"Shut your trap,"
hissed Pike, and obsequiously directed his gap-toothed grin at the Landsknechts.
"Hey, gentlemen, has always dreamed of serving in the cavalry, which is why he looks at those steeds so greedily."
"In the cavalry?" snorted the first Landsknecht. "What fantasies has the churl? He'll soon be a stable boy gathering muck from under the horses with a pitchfork and wheeling it out on a barrow."
"That's right, sire."
They went on, and soon reached a causeway running beside ponds and ditches. And suddenly they saw the red tiles of the towers of Vichima Castle looming over the lake above the tops of alders.
"Well, we're almost there," said the merchant. "Can you smell it?" "Ugh!"
Melfi grimaced.
"What a stench! What's that?" "Probably soldiers on the royal coin who died of hunger,"
muttered Pike behind their backs, making sure the Landsknechts didn't hear.
Almost makes your eyes water, doesn't it? Laughed one of them. Aye, thousands of military folk have wintered here, and military folk have to eat, and when they eat, they defecate. Nature has ordered things thus, and there's nothing you can do about it. And what's been shat out is carted to these ditches and dumped, without even being buried. In the winter, while the frost kept the shit frozen, you could stand it. But from the spring, oh! And more fresh soldiers are arriving and adding to the old heap. The other Landsknecht also spat. And can you hear that great buzzing? It's flies. There are swarms of them, an uncommon thing for early spring. Cover your gobs with whatever you can, for they'll get into your eyes and mouths, the bastards, and briskly. The quicker we pass by, the better. They passed the ditches, but didn't manage to lose the stench. On the contrary, Yara would have sworn that the closer to the town they were, the worse the fug was. Except it was more varied, richer in scale and hue. The military camps and tents surrounding the castle stank. The huge field hospital stank. The crowded and busy suburbs stank. The embankment stank. The gate stank. The berm stank. The small squares and streets stank. The walls of the great castle towering over the town stank. Fortunately, the nostrils quickly became accustomed, and it soon made no difference to them if it was dung or rotten meat or cat's piss or another field kitchen. There were flies everywhere. They buzzed annoyingly, getting into the eyes, ears and nose. They couldn't be driven away. It was easier to squash them on the face or chew them up. When they had just exited the shadow of the gatehouse, their eyes were struck by a huge mural depicting a knight with his finger aimed at them. The writing beneath the mural asked in huge letters, "What about you? Have you signed up?" All right," mumbled the Landsknecht. "Unfortunately." There were plenty of similar murals. You could have said there was a mural on every wall. It was generally the knight with his finger, but there was also often a solemn mother country with grey hair blowing around against a background of burning villages and babies on Nilfgaardian pikes. There were also images of elves with bloodied knives in their teeth. Yara suddenly looked around and found they were alone. He, the Landsknecht, and the merchant. There wasn't any sign of Pike, Akultich, the peasants from the draft, or Melfi. Yes, yes, the first Landsknecht confirmed his speculation, eyeing him closely. Your comrades scrammed at the first opportunity. They scarpered around the first corner. And you know what I'll tell you, lad? It's good that your paths have diverged. Don't strive for them to converge again. Shame about Melfi, muttered Yara. He's a good lad at heart. Everyone chooses his destiny. And you, come with us. We'll show you where to sign up. They entered a square in the middle of which stood a pillory on a stone platform. Townspeople and soldiers, greedy for amusement, were gathered around the pillory. A handcuffed convict, who had just been hit in the face with a lump of mud, spat and wept. The crowd roared with laughter. Hey! Yelled the Landsknecht. Look who they've put in the stocks! Why, it's Fouzon. I wonder what for? For farming. A fat burgher in a wolfskin felt cap hurried to explain. For what? For farming, the fat man repeated with emphasis. For what he sowed. Ha! Huh. Now, if you'll excuse me, you've dropped a clangor like a bull dumping on a threshing floor, laughed the Landsknecht. I know Fouzon. He's a shoemaker, the son of a shoemaker and the grandson of a shoemaker. He's never ploughed nor sown nor harvested in his life. You're exaggerating, I say, with that sowing. You really are. That's the bailiff's own words, said the burgher crossly. He's to stand in the pillory until twilight for sowing. For the villain sowed after being goaded on by Nilfgaard and for Nilfgaardian silver pennies. He sowed some strange crops, in truth. Foreign, I'll warrant. Let me think. Aha! Defeatism. Yes, yes, called the vendor of amulets. I've heard tell of it. Nilfgaardian spies and elves are spreading the plague, spoiling wells, springs and brooks with various poisons, and using devil's trumpet, hemlock, lepra, and defeatism. Bye, the burgher in the wolfskin nodded. They hung two elves yesterday, most probably for poisoning. Round that corner, The Landsknecht pointed. "Is the tavern where the conscription committee sits. A big canvas sheet is stretched out there with the Temerian lilies on it, which you know, of course, lad. You'll find it without any difficulty. Look after yourself. May we meet again in better times, God willing. Farewell to you too, merchant sir." The merchant cleared his throat loudly.
"Noble gentleman," he said, rooting around in his chests and boxes, "let me, as proof of my gratitude, for your help..."
"Don't trouble yourself, good fellow," said the Landsknecht with a smile. "We helped, and that's that. Don't mention it."
"Perhaps a miraculous ointment against lumbago?"
The merchant dug something out from the bottom of a box.
"Perhaps a universal, unreliable medicine for bronchitis, gout, paralysis, dandruff and scrofula. Perhaps a resinous balsam for bee, viper and vampire bites. Perhaps a talisman to protect you from the effects of the stare of the evil eye."
"And do you have, perhaps," the Landsknecht asked seriously, "something to protect one from the effects of bad victuals?"
"I do," beamed the merchant. "This is a most effective remedy made from magical roots flavoured with aromatic herbs. 3 drops after a meal should suffice. Please, take it, noble gentleman."
"Thanks. Farewell, sir. Farewell to you too, lad. Good luck."
"Honest, politic, and courteous," commented the merchant when the soldiers had disappeared into the crowd. "You don't encounter such as them every day. Well, but you turned out all right too, young master. What then can I give you? An amulet against lightning? A bezoar? A turtle shell effective against witches' spells? Ha! I also have a corpse's tooth for fumigation, and a bit of dried devil's tongue. It's good to wear it in your right shoe."
Yara tore his gaze away from some people doggedly cleaning a slogan from the wall of a building. "Down with the sodding war."
"Leave it, sir," he said. "Time I went..." "Ha!" cried the merchant, taking a small heart-shaped brass medallion from the box.
"This ought to suit you, young man. It's just right for young people. It's a great rarity, the only one I have. It's a magical amulet. It makes the wearer never forget his love, even though time and countless miles separate them. Look, it opens here, and inside is a leaf of thin papyrus. Suffice to write on the leaf the name of your beloved in magical red ink, which I have, and she will not forget, not change her heart, not betray you or cast you aside. Well?"
Yara blushed slightly. "I don't really know."
"What name?"
The merchant dipped a stick in the magical ink.
"Am I to write?"
"Ciri. I mean, Cirilla."
"There. Take it."
"Yara? What are you doing here by 100 devils?
Yara whirled around. "I had hoped," he thought mechanically, "that I was leaving my whole past behind me, that everything would now be new. But I almost unceasingly keep bumping into old acquaintances.
Mr. Dennis Cranmer."
A dwarf in a heavy overcoat, cuirass, iron vambraces, and tall fox fur hat with a tail, cast a crafty glance over the boy, the merchant, and then again over the boy.
"What are you?" he asked again sharply, ruffling his eyebrows, beard and moustache. "Doing here, Yara?"
For a moment, the boy considered lying, and to lend credence entangling the kind merchant into the false version. But he almost immediately rejected the idea. Dennis Cranmer, who had once served in the guard of the Duke of Ellender, enjoyed the reputation of a dwarf whom it was hard to deceive, and it wasn't worth trying.
"I want to join up."
He knew what the next question would be.
"Did Nenneke give you permission?"
He didn't have to answer.
"You bought it."
Dennis Cranmer nodded his beard.
"You simply fled from the temple, and Nenneke and the priestesses are tearing their hair out."
"I left a letter," muttered Yara. "Mr. Cranmer, I couldn't... I had to. It wasn't right to stay there idly when the enemy are in the marches, at a dangerous moment for the fatherland. And what's more, she... Ciri... Mother Nenneke didn't want to agree at all. Although she sent 3/4 of the girls from the temple to the army, she didn't allow me. And I couldn't..."
"So you did a runner."
The dwarf frowned sternly.
"By 100 bloody demons, I ought to tie you up with a stick under your knees and send you to Ellender by courier post.
or you locked up in the oubliette under the castle until the priestess has come to collect you. I ought to. He panted angrily. When did you last eat, Yara? When did you last have hot victuals in your gob?
Really hot? 4 days ago.
Come with me.
Itzlua, son.
Zoltan Chive, one of Dennis Cranmer's comrades, cautioned him.
It isn't healthy to guzzle your food so quickly without chewing properly. Where are you rushing to? Believe me, no one's going to take it away from you.
Yara wasn't so sure about that. A fistfight duel was taking place right then in the main room of the Shaggy Bear Inn. Two stocky dwarves, as wide as stoves, were punching each other so loudly it thudded amidst the roars of their comrades from the volunteer regiment and the applause of the local prostitutes. The floor was shaking. Furniture and pots were falling, and drops of blood from smashed noses were spraying around like rain. Yara was just waiting for one of the fighters to sprawl across the officer's table and bang into the wooden plate of pork knuckle, the great bowl of steamed peas and the earthenware mugs. He quickly swallowed a piece of fatty meat he had bitten off, assuming that what he swallowed was his.
I don't really get it, Dennis.
Another dwarf, called Sheldon Skaggs, didn't even turn his head when one of the fighters almost caught him with a right hook.
Since this boy's a priest, how can he join up? Priests aren't allowed to shed blood.
He's a student of the temple, not a priest.
I've never been bloody able to understand those tortuous human superstitions. Well, but it doesn't do to mock other people's beliefs. The conclusion, though, is that this young man here, although brought up in a temple, has nothing against spilling blood. Particularly Nilfgaardian blood. Eh, what, young man?
Let him eat in peace, Skaggs.
I'm happy to answer.
Yarrow swallowed a mouthful of pork knuckle and shoved a handful of peas into his mouth.
It's like this. You can spill blood in a just war, in the defence of higher reasons. That's why I'm signing up. The motherland is calling.
You can see for yourselves.
Sheldon Skaggs swept his gaze over his companions.
How much truth there is in the statement that humans are a race similar to and related to us, that we come from a common root, both us and them. The best proof is here, sitting before us, wolfing down peas. In other words, you can come across loads of similar stupid zealots among young dwarves.
Especially after the Maena battle, remarked Zoltan Chive coolly. Tons more volunteers always sign up after a victorious battle. The rush will stop when new spreads of Menokorn's army marching up the Aina, leaving behind only earth and water.
As long as the rush in the other direction doesn't start, muttered Cranmer.
I somehow don't trust volunteers.
Interesting that every second deserter is a volunteer.
How can you...
Yara almost choked.
How can you suggest something like that, sir? I'm joining up for ideological reasons, to fight a just and legitimate war. The motherland.
One of the fighting dwarves fell from a blow that, it seemed to the boy, shook the very foundations of the building. The dust rising a yard in the air from gaps in the floorboards. This time, the fallen dwarf, rather than leaping up and whacking his adversary, lay, clumsily twitching his limbs, prompting associations of a huge beetle flipped on its back. Dennis Cranmer stood up.
The matter is settled, he declared loudly, looking around the inn. The position of commander of the troop made vacant after the heroic death of Elkanah Foster, who fell on the battlefield at Maena, is taken up by, what's your name, mate? Because I've forgotten.
Blathko Grant.
The victor of the fistfight spat a tooth onto the floor.
Blasco Grant takes up the position. Are there any other contentious issues regarding promotions? There aren't? Well and good. Innkeeper, beer.
Where were we? A just war.
Zoltan Chive began to count, bending his fingers back.
Volunteers, deserters,
exactly,
Dennis interrupted. I knew I wanted to refer to something, and the matter concerned deserting and treacherous volunteers. Remember Visigerd's former Sintran Corps? The Horse Sons, it turns out, didn't even change their standard. I know that from the mercenaries of the Free Company, from the gang of Julia Pretty Kitty. Julia's gang quarrelled with the Sintrans at Maena. They marched in the vanguard of the Nilfgaardian troop under the same standard with the Lions.
The Mother Country summoned them,
Skaggs interjected morosely,
and Empress Ciri.
Quiet, Dennis hissed.
That's true, said a fourth dwarf, Yarpin Zigrin, who'd said nothing until then. quiet. Quieter than quietness itself. And not for fear of snoopers, but because you don't talk about things you have no idea about. Well, you, Sigrid,
Skaggs stuck out his chin,
do have an idea, eh?
I do. And I'll say one thing. No one, whether it's Emir Var Imris or the rebellious sorcerers from Thanedd, or even the devil himself, could make that girl do anything. They couldn't break her, I know that, because I know her. That bloody marriage with Emir is a hawk's various asses have been taken in by. That girl, I tell you, has a different destiny, quite a different one.
You talk, muttered Skaggs, as though you really knew her, Sigrin.
Drop it, snapped Zoltan Chive unexpectedly. He's right about that destiny. I believe it. I also have reason to.
Eh?
Sheldon Skaggs waved a hand.
Why this breath? Cyrilla, a mere destiny. The distant matters. While a closer matter, gentlemen, is Menno Corn and the Centre Army Group.
Aye, sighed Zoltan Chive. Something tells me a huge battle won't pass us by. Perhaps the biggest history has ever seen.
A great deal, mumbled Dennis Cranmer.
Truly, a great deal will be decided.
And put an end to even more.
Everything...
Yara belched, decorously covering his mouth with his hand.
Everything will end.
The dwarves eyed him up for a moment, keeping silent.
I don't quite understand you, young man,
Zoltan Chive finally said. You wouldn't like to explain what you have in mind, would you?
In the Ducal Council, Yara stammered, in Elendur, I mean, it was said that victory in this great war is so important because it's the great war to end all wars.
Sheldon Skaggs snorted and spat beer down his beard. Zoltan Chive burst out laughing.
Don't you believe so, gentlemen?
Now it was Dennis Cranmer's turn to snort. Yarpin Zegrin remained serious, looking intently and seemingly with concern at the boy.
Look, son, he said at last, very seriously. Evangelina Parr is sitting at the bar. She is, one must admit, large. Why, even enormous. But in spite of her size, beyond all doubt, she isn't a whore to end all whores.
Turning into a narrow and deserted alley, Dennis Cranmer stopped.
I must praise you, Yara, he said. Do you know what for?
No.
Don't pretend. You don't have to in front of me. It's praiseworthy that you didn't blink when Cyrilla was being talked about. It's even more praiseworthy that you didn't open your trap then.
Hey, don't make faces. I knew a lot of what went on behind Nennica's temple walls. A lot, you can believe me.
And if that's too little for you, then know that I heard what name the merchant wrote on that medallion for you. Keep it up.
The dwarf tactfully pretended he hadn't noticed the crimson blush that suffused the boy's face.
Keep it up, Yara, and not only in the case of Ciri. What are you staring at?
On the wall of a granary, visible at the end of the lane, was a lopsided, whitewashed slogan reading, Make Love, Not War. Just under that, somebody had scribbled in much smaller letters, And Take a Shit Every Morning.
Look somewhere else, idiot, Dennis Cranmer barked. Just looking at graffiti like that can get you into trouble, and if you say something at the wrong time, they'll flog you at the post. They'll flay the skin off your back. The judgments are swift here, extremely swift.
I saw the shoemaker in the pillory, muttered Yara, reputedly for sowing defeatism.
His defeatism,
the dwarf stated seriously, pulling the boy by his sleeve, probably lay in the fact that when he took his son to his troop, he wept, instead of cheering patriotically. They punish differently for more serious sowing. Come, I assure you. They entered a small square. Yara stepped back, covering his mouth and nose with his sleeve. About a dozen corpses were hanging from a large stone gallows. Some of them, their appearance and smell betrayed it, had been hanging there a long time.
That one, pointed Dennis, simultaneously driving flies away, wrote stupid graffiti on walls and fences. That one claimed that war is a matter for lords, and that the Nilfgaardian drafted peasants aren't his enemies. And that one told the following anecdote when he was drunk. What's a spear? It's a nobleman's weapon,
a stick with a poor man on each end. And there, at the end, do you see that woman? She was the madam of the military brothel on wheels,